You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Why don't I introduce us, Paul? I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter, which people can subscribe if they want. You are Paul Bloom, legendary Canadian psychologist, author of and publisher of the newsletter Small Potatoes, author of many highly regarded books, and recently triumphant. In fact, as people will soon see, your serotonin level is still a little higher than is really comfortable for anyone talking to you. But you triumphed in a debate, and there was a celebrity who was the other half of your debate team. We'll get to that, too. The debate involved sex, and that's why I'm saving it for later. This is great bait.
Yeah.
People have to stick around. But first, we're going to talk about something that continues to dominate the consciousness of the public south of the border here, where I am, America. And that is the shooting of Charlie Kirk. We're going to talk about a couple of things, several, actually. We're going to get around to a debate about video games. We disagree on whether video games may have contributed to this. But first, and I want to thank you for this, Paul, you have agreed, in defiance of the norms governing your profession, to provide a definitive and exhaustive psychological profile and diagnosis of the killer based on only fragmentary evidence. I know you've got a PowerPoint presentation, looking forward to it. You're going to tell us which drugs you would have prescribed had he been in your care, which he couldn't have, because you don't have the authority to prescribe drugs. You're not an actual psychiatrist.
I don't even, I'm not even, I can't even, like, I don't have the authority to call myself a clinical psychologist, because I am not.
Yeah, you can't even say, hey, you are somebody, cheer up.
You are my most famous client. Well, I think, you know, often you talk about your troubles before,
actually,
after.
Actually, no, your debate partner, oh, she's not your client.
No, she's not my
client.
I take notes as I'm talking to you, and it's privileged. Mm-hmm. So it's all good. Before we start, why don't you ask me how I'm doing?
I thought I did that, Paul.
No, you did not, actually. You never do.
I bet
really.
I did.
No, I don't think so. You, anyway.
Okay, Paul. Wait, I forgot. What's the question? Oh, Paul, how you doing?
Not great, Bob.
Now, oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Some of you may recognize that as a famous meme from Mad Men, where Pete Campbell is asked by Bob Benson. You go look it up on YouTube, type in Not Great Bob. And after we've been talking together for what, 8-12 years? And I've never used that line with you before, but I'm going to use it regularly. Because in fact, I am not great. I am coming back from a serious, very positive buzz, an extremely enjoyable sex debate in Chicago. And now I am wrapped up with this Charlie Kirk bullshit. This, partially because I'm talking to you, so I have to read up on it, but partially because you cannot, because, you know, this is, the U.S. is going into a steady decline. I have always been a sort of Steve Pinker, progress, everything's getting better, don't panic thing. Mm-hmm. And now I just think, we're just fucked. We are. This is terrible.
It is.
The political assassinations, serious attacks on free speech of the sort, which I have not seen in my life by the government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Prominent government figures talking about some version of a civil war, which you tweeted, and I don't normally curry favor with you, but your tweets on this issue are exactly right. And it is deeply, deeply a bad time. But anyway.
It is bad. It makes me wonder how we've maintained this kind of chipper air up to this point.
Yes,
it's going to get harder from here.
Your giddiness is kind of puzzling given the...
Although I do think it's nice of you to sympathize with my country, because it is genuinely grim, if you ask me, both the fact of the killing, the things it's symptomatic of socially and politically, and... the way the administration is reacting, it might be a slight exaggeration to say they're trying to turn into the burning of the Reichstag, but
it's the right idea. Yeah. Yeah.
And
I should say, by the way, maybe you want to say this, I know you've spoken this before, but I actually think political assassination is wrong. I think murder is wrong. So the Charlie Kirk killing was wrong, and I want to get on the record for this, because some people who don't say that with sufficient enthusiasm have lost their fucking jobs.
Yeah, and it could eventually, I was thinking, it could eventually get to YouTube. I mean, Google needs to curry favor with the government just like everyone else, more than most, since they're in so many games, including AI. And you can imagine, I don't want to give them ideas, but you can imagine AI scouring YouTube and saying, sorry, these guys are over the, you know, these 1,000 podcasts are over the line. Yep. I'm not kidding. I mean, that you know, that's not going to happen this year. Because, you could see this year the administration demanding that YouTube shows be taken down. That would not, it's totally consistent with what's happened. You know, Jimmy Kimmel bit the dust. Now, in that case, there's this pretext of kind of the FCC having the authority to intimidate him because it's a broadcast. Thing, and we could get into that. You saw, by the way, that the FCC head literally said about Kimmel. Do I have the quote here? Oh yeah, here it is. Quote: this is Brennan Carr, Trump, the Trump appointee, head of the Federal Communications Commission. We can do this the easy way or the hard way. Like as if there weren't already enough Godfather vibes surrounding this administration. And then he says, these companies can find ways to change conduct and take action, frankly, on Kimmel, or there's going to be additional work for the FCC. And then, you know, ABC, which had already sucked up to Trump by paying him off in a lawsuit, repeated the exercise by firing Kimmel. I think he's now officially fired. I think it's no longer just suspension.
Yep. And this is, by the way, during the same news cycle where a Fox News guy, I forget his name, Brian somebody, they were talking about mentally ill homeless people. And he suggested that they be forcibly euthanized, which he has actually later apologized for and said that was a bit too much. But he says they should be murdered.
Literally, and he added, lest there be misunderstanding, just kill him. He said, you know, the guy, did you see the video?
I did not see the video.
The one guy is saying, well, look, we're going to have to just, some of them, they're going to have to be involuntarily committed. If they do not accept the resources we offer, go to the homeless shelter, whatever, they're going to have to be involuntarily committed. For certain kinds of homeless people, I'm sure that's a defensible position. Kilmeade then says, yeah, or involuntary lethal injection. And the first guy at that point is just reflexively nodding. He says, yeah. And then he realized what he said. And he like freezes and Kilmeade says, just kill him. He literally said that. And then the host kind of goes on to another question. And Kilmeade, after days, finally apologizes, doesn't get fired. And by the way, Fox is under exactly the degree of federal authority as ABC. There's a whole broadcast thing. I mean, that whole thing is ridiculous now that most of these networks get most of their eyeballs.
And just to be clear, the Fox guy, what he said, like I said, is repellent. I think people have a right to say repellent shit. And so, you know, that's fine. But the idea of,
well, actually, like, though, I will say, I mean, this brings, well, go ahead.
Finish. No. I was just going to, like, if we're going to live in a regime where the federal government is going to make sure people don't say mistaken things or polarizing things on air, I think it is a bizarrely authoritarian regime. But at least one could imagine it could be applied fairly, in which case everybody who says something which is mistaken or offensive gets a heavy-handed FCC and a heavy hand of Trump's government threatening to destroy contracts and rule against the networks that they're on. Alternatively, you could have something where everybody gets to say pretty much whatever they want with merely some restraints about obscenity and so on. But the current thing where the Trump government is basically like slapping down everybody who doesn't, you know, kiss up to him. Mm-hmm. And the damage has been done. They don't have to do anything else right now because everybody else who has a huge mouthpiece connected to a network has gotten the message.
Oh, yeah. Well, remember, Stephen Colbert was already fired. It was less clear but after that, Trump said, as I understand it, you know, Kimmel and Fallon are next. I think you can find that quote, according to my wife. And if not, then send your emails to her.
Well, there's a new True Social thing by Trump saying, well, those guys weren't very funny. Great news. They're off the air. And then there's a couple of others we're going to go after now.
Yeah, no, it's endless. Remember, he has already chilled speech on campus. I had a conversation with Glenn Lowry that's up, and he said, yeah, it's tangible on Palestine. They succeeded in keeping professors from feeling they can speak out. And in media there's various different avenues. They got a payout from CBS on a phony, you know, a ridiculous libel suit. But on this, the Kill Me thing is interesting because, so first of all, let me back up. And if people think like we're imagining this, it's like J.D. Vance, Stephen Miller are saying very extreme things. Like J.D. Vance is saying, we're going to have to go after the Ford Foundation, take away, you know, suggesting to take away nonprofit staff. That's because, he says, they and the Soros Foundation, also in his sights, funded an article in The Nation that said Charlie Kirk's killing is justified. Only two problems. The article in The Nation doesn't say that, A, and B, The Nation hasn't gotten any Ford Foundation money in more than 5 years. And this is alarming to me because, like, if these are going to be the standards of evidence, if J.D. Vance can just spout total bullshit that bears no correspondence to the truth and say, this is the reason we're cracking down on X, we're in deep trouble. Now, the good, and Stephen Miller just sounded like, I am assiduously refraining from doing any more parallels with the late 30s, early 40s in Europe, but he sounds like a crazed person. The good news is that after Pam Bondi, her version of it, the attorney general, was we're going after hate speech, she got blowback from some of the people who on free speech on the right are more principled, who turned out to be the more MAGA-esque in a way. So Tucker Carlson, Kurt Mills, editor of The American Conservative, Megyn Kelly. And I'm hoping that Pam Bondi, by going that far, by putting it that way, has gotten some blowback that will help stifle the J.D. Vance, Trump, Stephen Miller impetus as well. But it's weird. Look, it's already bad. And yeah, it could get a lot worse.
And you know, I think anybody, and people support Trump for different reasons, but anybody who supports Trump because he's a champion of free speech, which, you know, was an idea many years ago, is has to be either changing their mind or has to be kind of an idiot. There is a sort of argument. So there's another view, which is that Trump is doing great. He's destroying the speech, the voice of the people we hate. This is fantastic. The self-interested response to that is Trump may not be president forever. And if you set up a regime, an administration's policies, customs, where you could do this, imagine a Democratic president who had a similar attitude. And maybe this is what something that Tucker Carlson's thinking. If all of a sudden, hate speech becomes a category in U.S. law or U.S. custom, and you could shut things down. Well, you know, when Kamala Harris, when Gavin Newsom is president, Tucker Carlson will be in his sights, and maybe Tucker Carlson will lose his job.
And well, I think they would go further and point to the past and say that actually we now know that the Biden administration was communicating, yes, with Twitter, for example, to get them to censor certain things about COVID, maybe things about Russiagate, yep, whatever. I don't know the details, but they're not imagining
they're
that.
Not imagining
I mean, there were forms of pressure being applied
on Facebook,
and
on
I think
X,
if nothing, yep, else, it should be transparent.
But what Trump is doing is, I think, unprecedented. Like, imagine this. This is an analogy I've heard. An analogy to George Floyd's death. Imagine it wasn't Trump who's president, and it's a Democratic president, George Floyd. At the time, there was a lot of sort of social pressure to mourn his death, to never say anything critical about him, and so on. Some people, I think, lost their jobs in a private level. But imagine the heavy hand of the government moving in. Imagine Fox runs something which is not sufficiently reverential about the death of George Floyd. And then the Democratic government says, you're going to be punished. Take these people off the air or when it damage your network. Imagine there was a call to have people fired from their jobs if they did not mourn George Floyd properly. Anybody would have to realize this is horribly immoral. And I wish people would have the perspective to see that this is just a mirror image of it.
Yeah, I saw a tweet from, I think, is it Jack Kosovich, one, you know, hardcore MAGA guy, saying, well, I don't recall them complaining when Roseanne Barr was fired. Now, I may be misremembering. I don't remember that being a result of government pressure, and that matters. If it was, I stand corrected. The other distinction is between hate speech and the actual exhortation to violence, which is illegal in certain forms. And I would just say what Brian Kilmeade did is arguably that. And shortly after he did it, somebody shot up some homeless people. I don't know that anybody died, but it's just the idea that Kilmeade gets a slap on the wrist. You want to look at what Jimmy Kimmel
I heard what, said, Jimmy, I heard what Jimmy Kimmel said, and amazing, he did a long riff on how Trump really didn't care that Charlie Kirk died and showed these weird clips of him boasting about his mom. But apparently it was a short thing he said before, which is something to the effect of MAGA people aren't, you know, that they're pretending that this is a guy at the left, but it's really one of their own, says it.
Yeah, I think probably what annoyed them most was when Kimmel showed that clip where Trump coming off the helicopter, somebody says, well, how you feeling, how you doing in the wake of the Kirk assassination? He says, oh, great, we're building this ballroom in the White House. Now, maybe he didn't hear the question, but it was kind of funny.
No,
so he shows that. But you're right, the pretext was him saying, and here I think he's victim of cocooning. In his media ecosystem, it was, as of Monday, still considered possible or even, well, likely, apparently, to him, that the killer was, you know, there had been this theory from early on before they apprehended anybody that this was the Nick Fuentes people, the Groypers, who had been critical of Charlie Kirk and they were behind it, false flag, blah, blah, blah. By Saturday night, there were reports that, you know, 2 days before Kimmel spoke, that look, the killer had a transgender roommate who was his lover. And I even emailed somebody that night and said, look, if this is true, so much for the Nick Fuentes theory. But apparently word hadn't reached Jimmy Kimmel because he said the MAGA gang desperately is trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them.
Yeah. Which was mistaken. Which is a mistaken implication.
Yeah, but we made mistakes.
Yeah, this is a mistaken implication.
Who? Not on the same level as what Brian Kilmeade did. I mean, this is just crazy.
By the way, I don't think what Kilmeade, his name's really Kilmeade. Kilmeade.
But that's excellent. Thank
okay,
you.
That's really good.
I'm not exhorting violence.
My understanding, and you know, again, I am not a lawyer, but that incitement of violence cause has always been taken very narrowly, and general claims that could incite violence, like we should go to war with Iraq, for instance, which is definitely an assignment. I would encourage people.
I've heard people say that.
Believe it or not, people say that.
Like
even
everyone I knew.
I think there was a famous case. I hope I'm not misremembering, but an early one where somebody basically said, I want to blow the fucking president's head off. And then he got charged with making a threat, incitement of violence. And said, no, it's just expression of, you know, he's just letting off steam. It's always been coded very narrowly. So what the Fox News guy said wouldn't be incitement to violence either. There's always some crazy person who takes you seriously, but that's not his fault. What he said is bizarrely repugnant, but not illegal and
shouldn't be. Well, and it's another thing that specifically has late 30s, early 40s German vibes. Come on. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's fucking sick.
Yeah. Well, he was saying what a lot of people think. There's a real dehumanization of the homeless. And I think he was saying this with regard to the wake of some horrific attack where a homeless guy killed somebody on a subway.
It's a problem, and the worse it gets, the more serious the intervention has to be. And as I said, if you want to say involuntary commission to, you know, whatever, to, you know, take them off the streets involuntarily, that's one thing. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the bombing the boats thing. Look, if this is really a big enough problem, which the Trump administration doesn't really think it is, because the truth is there's no like fentanyl or opioids coming from Venezuela, apparently, and that's what they claim to be their obsession. But you know, I mean, it's cocaine, and that's not in other contexts their focus. But, well, then say these guys get the death penalty, apprehend them, and have an adjudicatory process. Fine. That's the way we do it. Pass the legislation. Well, anyway. But back to the killer.
Okay.
Now, did you read the... So, he had this... He basically confesses in a Discord chat with his roommate, and it has a weird texture that some people have taken to be grounds to think that it's fake, and, you know, there are conspiracy theories associated with that. It doesn't strike me as plausible as fake. It is weird. Did you have a chance to...
Is this the one where he talks about getting back his gun? There were a couple of thing clips I've seen.
You might say he's... And look... I mean, let me just read a little bit. I mean, I guess I'd be obsessed with getting back the gun, too, if I thought that's the key to not getting caught.
Yeah.
But it's weird because, so first of all, he had left a note under his roommate, apparently his lover. I mean, I gather that Tyler Robinson is basically gay. His lover's biologically male, was in the process of transitioning or something. I don't know. But so he had left a note under the guy's keyboard saying, saying, I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk, and I'm going to take it. And then he messages him and says, drop what you're doing. Look under your keyboard. The guy does. And he goes, what? With question marks. You're joking, right? And he says, I'm still okay, my love, but I'm stuck in Orem for a little while. Longer yet, shouldn't be long until I can come home, but I gotta grab my rifle still. To be honest, I had hoped to keep the secret till I died of old age. I'm sorry to involve you. And the guy says, you weren't the one who did it, right? He says, I am, I'm sorry. The guy says, I thought they caught the person. They get into that. And then, yeah, from now on, he keeps getting back to the rifle. The guy says, why did you do it? He says, I had enough of this hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out. If I'm able to grab my rifle unseen, and then it gets beyond that, it gets almost comical how whatever the guy asks about, like, why did you do this and so on? He's like, you know, he's talking about getting his rifle. What are your views on this guy's brain?
I'm sorry. None at all. I mean, I've heard this idea. I watched Breaking Bad all the way to the end, and which was a very, very, very good series. And there's a scene at the end where Walter communicates with his wife, Skyler, and Walter's becoming a fugitive. And they have this sort of very scripted conversation where they make it very clear she's not involved in any of this. She didn't know about this. It's meant to be thought of as a spontaneous conversation, but it's carefully scripted to in that. And I've heard people make the analogy that there's aspects that look scripted. I don't know. It just looks like this guy just killed somebody and really wants his gun back because it might have his fingerprints on it. What did you see? You saw something more interesting.
I'm genuinely not sure. I wondered if, it's, you know, look, is he weird? Well, yeah, he assassinated a guy. That's not normal behavior. And his explanation of it is kind of weirdly casual almost. I suppose you can imagine somebody in his shoes being so obsessed with retrieving the rifle because they think that's the whole question of whether they'll get apprehended that they keep coming back to it. I did wonder, this whole business of leaving the note under his keyboard, whether he thought of this as kind of a gift to his roommate. Like, his roommate is transgender, and Charlie Kirk, of course, was not a fan of transitioning. And I don't know. I wondered about that. I don't have deep insights into the guy. I mean, he seems to have hugely overestimated the chances of actually getting away with this. I mean, I should look up the images, but those images in the parking garage, did he even have sunglasses on? I mean, dude, there's always cameras in parking garages. It's, but I don't know. So I guess we could move on to the video game argument if you have nothing to say about him, except that,
I'm so upset about what's happening, as they're, you know, obviously the political assassination is bad, but this is not the first political assassination in the last little while. What is it? Minnesota state senator Hardeman got killed by some crazy right wing guy, some crazy, very anti-abortion guy who had a list of 70 or 80 people he's going to go kill. So he goes to her house, kills her, kills her husband, shoots the fucking dog. And so why don't we have half mass for that? Why don't we have a, you know, national day of mourning for that? Because it's right wing. And when your president is asked about it, he says, I never heard of that. So the idea that this singular awful event is going to be viewed as sort of emblematic, that there's a political assassination culture in the States entirely led by left-wing transgender folk, is both a horrible incitement to the worst kind of hatred and violence, and empirically untrue.
Yeah, by the way, I looked at the picture. He did have sunglasses on in the parking garage.
Maybe he was a Luigi. Maybe he's a Luigi Mangione.
Well, Luigi had, of course, that was back, I guess, closer to the heart of COVID. Not that much, but Luigi always wore masks.
Luigi was a little while ago, wasn't he?
Well, how long ago was it? A year?
Yeah. So that was...
Anyway, he wore a mask, okay?
Luigi really did a good job. It was 2020, December 4th, 2024. So just a little while ago.
As far as what you're saying, I mean, of course, the administration, I mean, I will say, if they say, why is this a bigger deal than the killing of the Democrats? Charlie Kirk was better known.
Yeah.
He had a bigger following. That's not shocking, that part. But it's true that the administration, in attributing it to, quote, the left, is trying to justify an authoritarian crackdown. Now, that said, this has been endemic. This is how we got to where we are, to a large extent, I think, is people seeing the most extreme behavior on either side and attributing it to many, many people in the other side. Yep. That's what social media does.
Yep.
You show the craziest guy on the other side, and people say that's the way they are. And that's what whips people up to in a frame of mind in which, you know, killing starts.
You know, I heard a clip of Trump, and Trump was asked about what is our thoughts about the Charlie Kirk thing. And Trump, who's at his heart deeply unpredictable, says, well, Charlie Kirk always preached the doctrine of nonviolence. And I think nonviolence is the way to go here. And to be, you know, this, and I thought, what a great response. Of course, then he shifted and did other responses.
In that same segment, he said, we got to track down the radical left and, quote, beat the crap out of them.
Yeah, well, different messages.
Different. That was like, but that was 30 seconds later. Who of us doesn't have, changes
also,
of heart?
Also, I think there is a sort of narcissism, or to put it nicer, curse of knowledge, where in the political class that you belong to, I'm sure you knew who Charlie Kirk was. And Charlie Kirk is very well known within that community, Turning Point USA and so on. If you did a poll of Americans and you said, have you heard of Charlie Kirk? My bet is only quite a small minority would have heard of him. He wasn't Martin Luther King Jr. This guy, he was a guy.
No,
I heard his name, and I'm pretty plugged into politics because I talk with you every 2 weeks. I had a vague image of some guy being a debate me bro guy going to college campus. I had a good image of that. Didn't know. Wasn't like this major figure in my head. I think I would bet not 1 in 10 Americans would have heard of Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, I had heard of him. I didn't have a very clear idea. I mean, for years I got him mixed up with Charlie Sykes. It was two names. Charlie Sykes is actually, I think, a never Trump Republican, but you would hear these names. Now, I focused a little when Trump outsourced a certain amount of his get out the vote campaign during the last election to Charlie Kirk. But no, he wasn't, he wasn't Joe Rogan level.
Yeah, it wasn't Joe Rogan. He wasn't even Milo level.
No, but he was more important than Milo. Milo was just a clown who got sidelined by his own people. Breitbart itself said they severed links.
It was sort of a...
No, Charlie Kirk had influence. He was building a big and enthusiastic movement of young conservatives, yeah. especially Christians. And this is... a line was crossed in terms of the kind of person who was targeted, I would say.
No, I think it's true. And I also think that the people who kind of... The journalists, the political class who talk about all these things might have felt themselves particularly affected by this. Not necessarily because they knew Kirk, though many people did, and had interviewed him, but also because they're in the business of going and giving talks in places. And they may have felt... So, I heard... You know, Sam Harris, who is certainly no fan of Trump, saying, you know, I go to college, I'm going to go to college campuses. You know, the image of some guy getting shot in the neck because he says people things that people don't like is deeply terrifying to me. And
well, I think I told you when I debated Sam in Los Angeles.
Yes, I remember.
Like there was this long delay. It was like a half an hour late, 40 minutes late. I finally got on. We do the debate. Later, they tell me, well, there was a death threat to Sam. I'm like, well, I was sitting 2 feet from him. Maybe you could have just kind of let me know about that, you know, like, but they didn't. But he had a whole security team with him.
They would have jumped in front of him if necessary.
I'm sure Sam would have jumped in front of me to save my life.
I'm sure he would have. By the way, before we give up the Charlie Kirk discussion, it has been having effects even in humble University of Toronto. So some political science tenured professor, tweeted right after Charlie Kirk's shooting, basically something, I forget the exact words of the tweet, but, you know, some cunts deserve to be shot. And then she was immediately put on leave. And she was known for sort of heated tweets in the past. It turns out that she was actually not making reference to Charlie Kirk, but to other people, I think IDF people or something like that. But, and my feeling is this, you don't put somebody on leave for saying an ugly tweet, you know?
What was the job? Who was it? It's somebody high profile.
Tenured professor here. It's in political science.
Yeah. I mean, if I felt that this was kind of volitional on the university's part, if I didn't imagine that this is under a sense of pressure from the government, it would bother me less. Because, look, speech norms are a thing.
The tweet, by the way,
can say things in public that will get you fired. Companies have a right to do that. The problem is when the government, in lots of different ways, by denying funds of universities, getting university presidents fired, and all this FCC stuff and whatever, you know, Ford Foundation, whatever they're going to do next gets involved.
But wait, I agree with that. I agree that the government, that it is particularly odious that the government is now getting involved in policing speech in a way that, you know, has to contravene in a deep way the spirit of the American Constitution. By the way, here's her tweet. Her Twitter name is Dr. Ruth Marshall is kicking against the pricks. And the tweet is, shooting is honestly too good for many of you fascist cunts. It's C.NTS, but the Toronto News has blocked that out, so I'm inferring. You know, never know.
Well, I would say, I mean,
but
did she have tenure?
Yeah.
Did she have tenure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Well, that makes it so, right, particularly
so,
abhorrent.
So I think, you know, if you work for a PR agency and you tweet something like this, I think it's legitimate to say, look, this is going to make our agency look very bad. You know, you're fired, you're on leave. I do think that there is a justification for protection for tenured professors to say all sorts of odious shit. It's not limitless, but I think this is not, I think that this should, that she should not have been put on leave. And I think if the story I know is true, that has been reported, this is cowardice on the part of the university I work for.
I mean, especially, I shouldn't go there, but I mean, she's talking about people who, according to various panels and authorities, are involved in genocide. That's kind of different from saying it about Charlie Kirk. But when they fired her,
I think they actually said it about anybody. She wasn't fired. She's put on leave.
By the way, one of the conspiracy theories, which I'm sure is wrong, though, you know, of course, there's Israel. There's an Israel-related conspiracy theory. But what there is this...
Israel killed Charlie Kirk?
No, Israel didn't. But it is true that I guess it was in August, he and Megyn Kelly, see, he had always been a stalwart Israel supporter. Then he started to waver. And we now know that Bill Ackman staged an intervention, came to visit. Bill, the billionaire who got university presidents fired on Israel speech issues to enforce, you know, a pro-Israel speech code on campus. No, he intervened. And I think the timing is at least reported to be that it was a day very shortly after this visit in August that Charlie Kirk, there's a video of him with Megyn Kelly saying, they're both saying, I'm sick of being pressured by these pro-Israel people. If, look, you don't understand me. Kirk says, you got me backwards. Putting pressure on is going to have the opposite effect. I mean, they're really pissed. And, but no, Israel's not behind this.
You're going to talk about, you were going to blame violent video games at the core of all of this as a single and most important cause.
See, Paul, do I put words in your mouth? Have I ever done that?
Never, never.
I don't recall ever doing.
Sometimes you generously steel man my views, but besides that, never.
I do. So. Here's my, well, your view is probably the standard. No studies have shown that video games contribute to violent behavior, right?
My view
and
is,
not to put other words into your mouth, but, and blah, blah, blah.
My right? view is that, and my view is also that there is so much evidence, both sort of sociological and common sense and experimental, that video games play no causal role in any of this violence, to the point that as video games rose in prominence and became increasingly more violent, there was a corresponding drop in violent crime in the United States.
So, well, yeah, but there's a billion other variables going on.
There's a billion other, but there's not a hint of it. Anyway, so go on.
Well,
I have the predictable view.
If your hypothesis is not that video, that first-person shooter games, as a rule, make the players more violent in real life, or even that they make an appreciable fraction, really, more violent, but that there will be 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 100,000 cases where the person's mental state and or circumstances are such that, yes, it's the involvement with first-person shooter games that push him over the edge. I mean, along with other things. I mean, you have to distinguish between necessary and sufficient conditions. There can be a number of necessary... For example, this guy. It's possible that, A, had he not been immersed in first-person shooters, he wouldn't have killed him. That's my claim. And B, that if his family hadn't taught him how to use guns, he wouldn't have killed him. It could be that neither is sufficient, but both are necessary. I mean, plus, yeah, he had to have a transgender lover, and he, whatever. So, there could be a lot of...
I'm missing part of the stories. Was he particularly... Every young guy plays first-person shooters, and I played first-person shooters, Marathon, Halo, old-school ones.
That's why we do these remotely, Paul.
But is there... I haven't heard this news story. Was he particularly obsessed with them?
Oh, yeah. No, there was a quote from somebody who knew him, I think, years ago, and said... Oh, he was a massive Halo guy, meaning the game.
I was
game
a massive Halo,
Halo
guy.
It's like I said, we're doing this remotely, Paul. Let me just finish it. If that's your hypothesis, like 1 in 100,000,
yeah,
it's essentially impossible to do the study that will test the hypothesis. And I submit that no such study has been done, and none of this correlational bullshit, like, oh, over the time in the growth of video games, this changed and that changed and that didn't change. I mean, come on. Life is too complicated for that.
I think that's true, but you're going to throw out hypotheses like that. And you're right. You can't, it'd be impossible to preclude it. There's a corresponding one, which to me is equally plausible, that for every 2 out of 100,000 people, playing video games satiates the need for violence so that it makes them peaceable and stops them from being a mass shooter.
Okay, but here's the problem. That could be too.
Yeah.
That could be too. I'm not ruling that out. I doubt it for the following reason. And this is the reason I think likely in some cases it makes the difference is this. Now, Paul, you're a psychologist. You've probably heard the phrase positive reinforcement.
Positive. Yeah. Yeah. It's old school. Okay.
Skinner, although Skinner. We can do a Skinner take. I mean, Skinner focused on the positive reinforcement of behavior, but I think we can also talk about the positive reinforcement of the impulses leading behavior. So anyway, what a first person shooter game does is. repeatedly reinforce both the impulse, kill the bad guy, and acting on the impulse, pulling the trigger. A billion times, you do it and you feel better. That's positive reinforcement. Now, I understand that they understand the difference between the video game and real life, but I would really be pretty shocked if that massive reinforcement of that impulse had no effect on the impulses they feel in the real world. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, one thing about it is the causality almost certainly goes the other way around, which is that nobody forced this guy to play hours and hours of violent video games, first-person shooters. So the question is, why did he do it? Why did he do it more than 99% of other people? This isn't as true. Presumably, he brought something to the table, some pleasure in doing this. Now, I don't think, I think for the most part, he might just find it fun to run around and hide and so on. It's war games, people like that. It's very social activity you do with other people and so on. I think that the reinforcement you get from doing it is very circumscribed, which is, it's really fun while I'm sitting at my computer to click and shoot the aliens. Whether that extends to going on to a college with a gun, a rifle, and walking up to somebody, I think it's entirely different.
But first of all, games like Halo and Call of Duty, it's not aliens, right? I mean, I've never played either, but he played Call of Duty, he played Halo. Certainly Call of Duty, you're killing humans.
Well.
And these things are increasingly,
Okay, go on.
They're increasingly realistic. I assume they're now virtual reality versions. I don't know. I guess most people don't play that version. But no, I bet a lot do. Anyway, what were you going to say?
I'll say I agree with you. I mean, it could really be a fact that repeatedly playing these games, first-person shooters, playing cowboys and Indians at home, Nerf guns, all of that stuff, raises your propensity to get pleasure from real-world violence. There's nothing really exciting. It just is so clear that that has not happened. That in fact, the same generation that is in love with violent video games.
It's not clear. What do you mean it's clear that it hasn't happened in 100,000 cases? What's the evidence? What are you talking about?
It's clear it doesn't happen as a rule. I can't respond to one out of every 100,000 cases. But then, just as you know about positive reinforcement, you know about satiation. So the idea is you get bored with doing something in a sort of a simulated environment, so you don't want to do it in the real world. And so
satiation is a short-term effect. More frequent repetition is a long-term consequence of positive reinforcement. And what you said about the disposition, sure. So maybe the kind of guy he was already, the fact that he played the video game reflected something that made him 70% more likely to kill somebody than the average person, which, of course, is a super, super low probability. And then actually playing the games adds to that. I mean, these are not mutually exclusive arguments. They're not, that's not a counter to the dynamic I'm suggesting.
If on the whole there was a substantial connection, we would see it in a million experiments as well as in society at large. You would really see, as the video game usage goes up, crime should go up. Whether or not there's a 1 in 100,000, 1 in a million thing, you're right. I can't know. But you can. But again, there's not the opposite effect too. The opposite effect is perfectly plausible, which is you have a violent impulse, say, and in the absence of any simulated world, you have to go beat up people and shoot people. But now I got this violent impulse. I'll play it on Halo for 6 hours a day, and then I'll be calm.
But you know that is not what positive reinforcement is for. It's not the way it works. The whole you're right, there is short-term satiation, but longer term, it is literally the case that the reason evolution invented positive reinforcement is to get you to do things more often.
But we're both
to get you to repeat them and repeat them and repeat them.
And if this was right in general, as applied to video games, you would see some sort of effect in a million studies and in the real world. But you're saying that maybe for a 1 in 100,000, your theory works.
Paul, fine. Tell me, what is the study designed for? Describe the study that actually tests the hypothesis I gave you.
Oh,
like 1 in 100,000.
Absolutely no study in the world could do that. You don't even need to have a positive reinforcement. If it was positive reinforcement, it wouldn't be 1 in 100,000. You're saying there's some magical thing that hits one in 100,000
No,
people.
I'm saying the threshold of actually going and killing somebody is a threshold rarely reached, period, and by anybody. We know that.
What's the study showing? So what's the study showing my argument is wrong? That 2 out of 100,000 people, it's totally plausible, get their violent impulses out on this imaginary game that cons them, makes them better people in the real world.
There's no study. It is contrary to what I think what we know about positive reinforcement, but I'm not saying
but
there is.
My theory
all I'm arguing against, it's so routine for people like you to say, this is ridiculous. Haven't you seen the studies? It's not ridiculous. And by the way, I'm not arguing for shutting down video games. I mean, this is one reason some people get so outraged by this is like, you're threatening, this is free speech, using video games. I didn't say anything about what we do about it if it's true. And like I said, we'll probably never know. But to me, there is no basis for trying to laugh people out of the room when they suggest that these things play a role.
But there's
and
no,
B, our intuitions, what we know about human psychology, I think works more in my direction than yours.
But you can, the positive reinforcement, that's your the fundamental psychological process. That's going to explain it. If that were true, it would happen more generally. If you're arguing it happens 1 out of every 100,000 people, it's a very, very, very special phenomenon. And I'm just going to argue, yeah. I'm going to argue, in fact, I'm going to make a parallel argument, which is people believe for a while that access to pornography would positive reinforce blah, 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 and cause an increase in sex crimes. Just like video games, as pornography became increasingly more available, sex crimes dropped. I'm not saying it's causal, but all I'm saying is there's no evidence for either of these sort of simulated activities having real world ramifications. And I would agree with you. If it did happen, we'd say, oh, that's positive reinforcement at work. But it didn't.
I mean, I wouldn't say, it depends on the nature of the pornography as to whether I would even imagine that it might increase sex crimes. I don't know how many people do like violent rape pornography. I don't know, but it would depend partly on that. But again, there's so many things involved in changing mores. And, you know, I'm not sure we know. I mean, given the changing norms as to what qualifies as sexual assault, changing definitions almost, it's hard to say. I mean, for example, there's been an increase in alleged date rapes just because people used to never allege it, but you know, because they didn't think they were supposed to.
No, but, you're right. Actually, the definition has expanded of sexual assault, not mm-hmm. retracted. So you would expect if everything stayed constant, there'd be more and more sexual assaults on the record. And if you looked at the FBI reports, it would just go up and up and up. But in fact, up until over, as a general trend from 1980 to present, it's gone down and down and down and down. Through an era where anybody can go onto their computer and see the most sexual.
Well, I'm not claiming an effect. I do think that's a lot more complicated because, you know, that could keep you off the street, so to speak, in a more relevant
way. And so can violent
video
violent
games
right?
do. No, but if we're talking about one assassination, it doesn't matter. It's not like, I mean, it's not like, well, he's walking around, maybe he sees Charlie Kirk. No, it's like the question, does he plan this
look,
one?
We're talking about pornography, mm-hmm. this is a very natural segue to my Chicago
It's a good
sex
segue.
Debate.
Now, I think it's about time to, I mean, we'll tell people what we're going to talk about in overtime. I think we should go into overtime before long. And let me just say, I think this has been a very healthy discussion because we're about to talk about this debate that you won. And I know that gave you a serotonin high. So I think it's good that we just had a debate you lost. It just kind of put, you know, bring some stability to your life, you know?
It keeps me humble. I find it very useful to be kind of.
That's what I'm here for, man. I'm doing this for you. This podcast is not about me, Paul.
It's a very Buddhist experience. It's just I when I'm done, I just want to. I don't even have a self. I'm just egoless.
You know, it's like Bobby Fischer said when they asked him, you know, the former and now dead chess champion. What he loved about the game of chess?
Go ahead.
He said, when I look over the table and see that my opponent's ego has been crushed. That's the way I feel, Paul. They say, why do you like podcasting with Paul Bloom? I say very much the same thing.
I think what happened was when you beat up on a China guy, the guy in reviews, it's like these things where you develop a taste for blood.
It's positive reinforcement. This is exactly it, Paul.
Well, Okay.
Well, if I had not beat up on the Chinese, did you ever listen to that podcast?
No, I'm saving it.
This is Jordan Schneider. Go listen, folks. I did not beat up on him. He was.
That's not what I
whining.
Hear.
Not
you
whining. That's too unkind. But that had that is what pushed me over the edge and led me to humiliate you.
You know what I think?
It felt good.
You know what I think? I think probably when you're not on a podcast, you play a podcast video game where you just kind of tap and for imaginary opponents, defeat them with your violent arguments.
Someday, this is all training data I'm generating with a podcast, and then someday I'm going to have a simulated Bob podcast thanks to all this training data we're going to feed into the AI.
What I am waiting for, and I think I'm going to see it in my lifetime, is you having a podcast with you, with an AI avatar of you. That'd be amazing.
Hey, I haven't done that, but I did have one of the first AI podcasts years ago, ChatGPT. It was about cognitive empathy. I remember that.
By the way, which is, I don't know if we need to discuss this because it's been discussed to death, but one of the many reasons I'm sort of in not great Bob mode is because I've started to read this book by Yudkowsky and his co-author about if you build it, everybody dies. I'm listening to
you know who's significant other is? You know who his co-author's significant other is, Bob Blum?
Ayla.
Your debate partner.
Yes. So I'm one degree of separation from this guy. And then, yeah.
So we can talk about the book too in overtime. Yeah, her name is, how does she pronounce it?
Ayla.
It looks like a Ayla? I thought it was Ayella or something. Anyway, she's a well-known for being, I guess what, libertarian?
Rationalist, I say. I'll say before we go to break, I had not met her before and everything. And mm-hmm. She actually has this enormous database about fetishes. She has a survey that about 800,000 people have completed. And I found her to be super smart, fun, and a great debater. So we did very well.
I was actually in two different small discussion groups with her at a conference a couple of years ago. She is smart. And so she is, I thought she was like a former sex worker and then OnlyFans person. And as a libertarian, insisting that there shouldn't be a stigma associated with that.
And she's a champion of polygamous relationships. Not for everybody, but she thinks that it should be more broadly accepted.
Mm-hmm. That's a big thing in the rationalist community.
Yeah.
I mean, not huge, maybe, but I know other rationalists who are... I had a whole conversation with Jeffrey Miller, who's one of them.
Oh, yeah. Was he on your show?
Yeah, about this. It was a whole polygamy discussion.
Oh. I'm going to go back to the archives. That sounds interesting.
I know so before we go into overtime, what was the debate about? You were declared triumphant, you and Ayla. What was it?
There were three topics. We were on the third topic, which is sexual desire configured by the internet or is it basically innate? And we argued that it was innate against Blasi and Catherine D, who argued it was configured by the internet. They did very well. They had some good arguments.
You found people who think that sexual desire is not innate?
Well, to be fair.
I could have won that debate, man, let me tell you.
To be fair.
But go ahead.
Well, the audience, I think, was biased and they get shaped by the internet. And to be fair, to some extent, it probably is shaped by the internet. To a large extent, it's innate. It was an argument of degree. There were also two other topics, which I will raise. One topic was, will AI replace porn stars? And the second topic is it infidelity if you have a romantic or sexual relationship with an AI chatbot?
Oh, okay. So there were some good things to debate.
It was hugely fun.
So we'll talk about that in overtime. I hope we'll have time to talk a little about Robert Redford, who
died. Yeah.
I watched the first episode of this show you tout called...
Andor. I hear you. You told me that you were not so impressed. It starts off slow. It starts off
discuss this. Don't leave it in the locker room, as Mickey used to say.
Okay. I will recount the things that I don't give it for the free customers. But it's Steve Pinker quoted this too. It was a New Yorker cartoon after Indecent Proposal came out with Robert Redford and Woody Harrelson and Demi Moore. The movie where Robert Redford offers Demi Moore $1 million to sleep with him and the consequence of that. And in the cartoon, this couple is leaving the theater and the husband says to the wife, would you sleep with Robert Redford for $1 million? And she says, yes, but it would take me a while to come up with the money.
You know, there's a related joke that I'm going to tell in overtime. So And also, it sounds like maybe we'll discuss Eliezer Yudkowsky's much-discussed book, If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies.
I have not
dies.
Read it yet. I just started it.
It's about video games. Just kidding. It's about AI. To get into overtime, you just have to become a paid subscriber to either the Non-Zero newsletter or the Small Potatoes newsletter. Make sure it's the right one, though. Of the thousands of Small Potatoes newsletters. No, Paul Bloom, Small Potatoes, or Robert Wright Non-Zero.
Or both.
Either way, or both. Well, we'll...
If you did,
we were gonna. Never mind.
If you did, but right now I'll say if you do both, you can listen to us twice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's such, yeah,
otherwise, that's there. Technically that's not technology
can't
would not
done.
Permit that otherwise. So we encourage that. But in any event, thanks for sticking with us this long. Feel free to smash like buttons, rate and review the podcast, click the like button on our newsletters. Anything else you'd like them to do for you, Paul?
No, that should do it. I can't wait to hear the Robert Redford joke. Oh, is this?
No, it's not a Robert. It's not a Robert. Although I'll repeat some of the joke that just had me in stitches when I was 12 and Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Anyway, so thanks.
Okay.
We're heading into overtime.
Bye.
Here we go.